You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Pakistan might be one of the most important countries in the world. It's strategically located, nuclear-armed, extremist-filled, and constantly careening from one crisis to the next, meaning that it has an outsized impact on global stability. Journalist Ahmed Rashid chronicles the various problems facing Pakistan and the vexing choices facing U.S. policymakers as our country disengages from Afghanistan in his new book called Pakistan on the Brink. It's published by Viking. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Rashid back to our program today. Hello.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
For the past few years, U.S. policymakers have referred to Afghanistan and Pakistan as AFPAC. Are the fates of the two countries inextricably intertwined?
Well, in one respect, they are, and that is how will this U.S. withdrawal take place? Will it lead to peace in Afghanistan and an end to the present civil war? That will have a hugely positive impact on Pakistan. But Pakistan has its own list of problems and troubles, you know, which have nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. They include, you know, extremism. There's an insurgency in two of the four provinces. There's mayhem in the larger city of Karachi, a lot of ethnic and sectarian warfare there. There's a crumbling economy. There's no energy.
There's an independence movement in Baluchistan, isn't
there? And of course, yes. I mean, that's one of the insurgencies that's going on. It's, in fact, a movement for separatism and independence. And it has the Pakistanis very worried because it's got a lot of notice recently by the Americans.
But Pakistan's interest in Afghanistan also involves its concerns about India. So should we be calling this AFPAC or should we be calling it INAFPAC or AFPAC-IN?
Well, you know, I mean, when Obama came in, he tried to bring India into this AFPAC thing, knowing fully well and realizing quite astutely that you can't satisfy Pakistan without it having some accommodation with India. And India was necessary to bring peace to Afghanistan and to get the Pakistanis to cooperate on Afghanistan. But the Indians kicked up a fuss, and unfortunately Obama backed down. And India was dropped from this whole AFPAC thing and is now very much outside it, but is still a major player.
Now, you met with President Obama a few days before he was inaugurated. Did he grasp, did you think, the scope of the problems he faced with Afghanistan and Pakistan? Because he ran on a platform of getting more involved in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, I think he was very well briefed. He clearly knew what he wanted to do. He was very keen to improve relations with Pakistan at that time. He was very keen to improve relations with Iran and to have some kind of dialogue with Iran. And of course, at the back of his mind was a pullout from Afghanistan, but a very keen desire to leave, you know, the region at peace. But since then, of course, we've seen, you know, a lot of his initiatives, I feel, have failed because they've not been carried through with any degree of consistency.
Well, you get the feeling that they're kind of adjusting, improvising on the fly.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we've seen so many policies executed in the last 3.5 years. It's been quite extraordinary. None of them have been fully completed.
And you note that Richard Holbrooke, the special envoy on AFPAC, who died recently, could never even get a one-on-one meeting with the president. Why? Didn't the president consider this an important place?
No, it wasn't that. It was that, you know, the State Department had been handed over to the president's rival, Hillary Clinton, who became Secretary of State. Now, for the first 2 years, even though Obama and Secretary Clinton had a very good relationship, their underlings literally refused to talk to each other. So because Holbrooke was the chief foreign policy advisor for Hillary, and because, you know, he was very much in her camp, the Obama people at the National Security Council refused to organize meetings between him and Obama regularly. And that, of course, was a disaster.
Now, there also, Obama was sending out mixed signals. He was saying that he wanted a surge in Afghanistan. He wanted to pull out at the same time.
Exactly.
How does that play with the Pakistanis, let alone President Karzai?
Well, it played very negatively in the region because, you know, the Taliban said, well, fine, the Americans are leaving, so we'll just step up our fighting. The Pakistanis were stunned by this because they had not been consulted on this at all. And if you remember, this leaving in 2014 was added at the last minute by people in the White House. The Pakistanis wanted to be consulted. They wanted to be part of the process, and they weren't. And Karzai, of course, was also deeply disappointed, because then what was the point of sending all these troops to Afghanistan if you were also announcing the day that they would withdraw?
Hasn't the U.S.-Pakistani relationship always been a bit of a roller coaster ride? Is it very much on the down point now?
Well, you know, we should remember that Pakistan was a key ally of the United States during the Cold War for more than 30 years. And
India resented it.
And India was in the other camp. India was a Soviet ally at that time and was a socialist country and resented this friendship. Now, of course, the it's all been reversed in a way. Both the Bush and the Obama administration are very close to India. They've given special status to India. They've recognized India's nuclear weapon program. None of this has come about for Pakistan.
But during the years when we had very good relations, didn't we in some ways create some of the situation that we now have to deal with, like giving them a lot of military aid and propping up the ISI?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, that has been critical to this deterioration in the relationship. The fact that the United States had a relationship with the military and the intelligence, you know, rather than the people of Pakistan and the civilian politicians. That was the first thing. I think the second thing is that, you know, so much was taken for granted after 9/11, that Pakistan was now an ally, that Pakistan helped U.S. defeat the Taliban. But, you know, all the Taliban, when the defeated Taliban came to live in Pakistan. And President Bush, in two terms, never addressed this issue.
Well, it's also apparent that the Taliban were helped over the years by the ISI. So Pakistan seems to have had two different policies going on at the same time. Was the ISI working independently of the governments, the various governments that were in place, the Bhuttos and whatever, or were they somehow secretly working together and sending out different messages?
No, we had throughout the first 8 years, we had a military regime under President Musharraf. Now, you know, he was commander-in-chief of the army as well as being president.
And the Pakistani army runs an awful lot
of course.
Pakistan. He runs a lot of the businesses too, doesn't it?
The intelligence and the army were working very much together under Musharraf. And the intelligence is not a separate wing. It's very much part of the military. It's the military that has been running these foreign policies, which have been extremely negative. And, of course, you know, you're right. I mean, the military has a great stake in the economy. It has perks and privileges, which it doesn't want to get rid of.
Is that why, despite the fact that both countries separated on equal footing in 1948, India now is going through an incredible boom while Pakistan is really lagging behind?
Well, the sort of meltdown in Pakistan really occurred during the Musharraf era when, you know, he was getting $2-3 billion a year from the Americans. He didn't invest in the economy, in the people of Pakistan, in education, in all the things that were really badly needed on the ground.
What was he doing with the money? Putting it in his pocket?
He was arming the army for a conflict with India. Rather than looking at the rise and growth of terrorism on Pakistani soil, which would, as it has to is today, posing a serious threat to the country.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid. His book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, published by Viking. A major parliamentary review opened today in Pakistan concerning U.S. drone strikes there. There have been more than 200 drone attacks since 2008. How many people have been killed?
Well, certainly over 1,000. And the Pakistanis claim that quite a few of them are civilians. The Americans claim that very few of them are civilians. We'll never know, really.
Does anyone in Pakistan publicly support the drone strikes?
Well, there are people, yes. I mean, you know, there are even people in those areas who support the drone strikes, who say that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have been harassing us, and as the Pakistan army has not taken out these people, at least the drone strikes are. But, you know, it's a very polarizing issue. There's for and against, you know, the drone strikes. And even though, by and large, I think the public now is against the drone strikes, the Americans are certainly not going to stop them.
Because we actually, it's become one of the hallmarks of the Obama administration, and not just in Pakistan, also Yemen and Somalia.
Yeah.
Haven't WikiLeaks disclosures revealed that the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, has been complicit in the CIA drone program?
Well, this is the whole irony that, you know, some of the drones that were bombing Taliban and Al-Qaeda inside Pakistan, some of these drones took off from air bases in Pakistan. And these were facilities that Musharraf had given the Americans, after 9/11, and continued until last year. And this one air base where the drones were based and American operators were based, the CIA was based, was there for 9 years. So again, you know, the Pakistani authorities have been playing this double game with its own people. On the one hand, condemning the drone strikes, but on the other hand, allowing them to take off from Pakistan.
But they have changed recently. Most NATO supplies for the Afghan war effort have been rerouted and are no longer traveling through Pakistan. Is that because the Pakistanis are protesting this sort of thing?
Well, you know, there's been a complete breakdown in relations since November when 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed on the border by NATO helicopters. Pakistan then broke off relations with the U.S. It has not met with any U.S. officials, and it closed this key road, which is supplying U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
So now they're coming through Siberia. I wouldn't have thought Russia would have been any more amenable than Pakistan.
Yeah, but the traffic through Russia and Central Asia is very, very expensive. It takes much longer. It's very expensive. It's like, you know, containers have to spend, a week or 2 weeks on the railway or on the road, whatever it is.
So is that affecting the war effort in Afghanistan?
No, so far the Americans are saying it isn't. But, I mean, I'm sure there is a much more careful handling of things like fuel, for example, which was largely coming from Pakistan. But I think the Americans are very rapidly denuding their support from Pakistan and stepping up the increase of supplies from the north.
There are also calls in Pakistan for tighter controls on foreign security companies that are operating in the country. How many contractors are working in Pakistan? Are they all American companies?
Well, you know, this is the other thing that happened after 9/11, that Musharraf gave a carte blanche to the Americans to come in and operate. So we had, at one point, we had hundreds of CIA agents and thousands of contractors who were working for the CIA, trying to dig up information on bin Laden, on other terrorist groups, etc. Now, the point is that, you know, this was a military regime that allowed all this to happen. And right now, of course, the government is complaining that this was happening. But the fallacy of all this is that the military had allowed it to happen itself. Now, of course, relations have got worse, so we want to throw everyone out. I strongly believe that the new relationship that will come about will be of a different character than before. I don't think you're going to get that kind of cooperation from Pakistan that the U.S. had before. And secondly, I think the U.S. has to now concentrate on trying to get Pakistan to shift its foreign policy priorities away from India and more towards, you know, dealing with its internal problems.
I want to return to that after we take a little break. My guest is Ahmed Rashid, whose bestseller Taliban was on the New York Times, was number one in the New York Times bestseller list when it was published. Then came Descent into Chaos. Now, Pakistan on the Brink, the Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. It is published by Viking. We're back with Ahmed Rashid. His latest book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. It is published by Viking. You mentioned that we're trying to convince Pakistan to improve relations with India. And every so often we get news reports, you know, and suddenly the cricket national cricket teams are playing, and that's a good sign. There are trade discussions. The borders are eased. But it never really seems to go all the way. Is that just because of Kashmir?
Well, you know, relations have improved over the last couple of years, and there's less tension on the border. But, you know, there are two outstanding issues. For the Pakistanis, it's Kashmir. The Indians want to have good relations but keep the tension going on Kashmir. And for the Indians, you have a problem with these extremist groups who are in Pakistan.
Who come into Mumbai and
exactly,
kill people.
Who carried out the massacre in Mumbai, who attack targets in Kashmir. And these extremist groups are still in Pakistan. They have, if you like, support from the authorities, and there's no clampdown on them. And, you know, this is the biggest concern of India. So, you know, both countries are talking at odds with one another, basically. Their primary concerns are completely separate and different.
Well, if Kashmir were resolved, maybe all of this would be over, but that doesn't seem to be possible.
No, I mean, at the moment, not. I think, you know, this is going to be a very long haul. And right now, the tensions between India and Pakistan have actually extended to Kabul, because the Pakistanis are very suspicious of Indian intentions in Afghanistan. And that's where now the big tensions are.
Should they be? Is India really interested much in Afghanistan?
Well, certainly India has had very close ties with Afghanistan right through the monarchy, right up to, and of course, even during the Soviet occupation. So India can't be ousted from Afghanistan, as some Pakistanis would like it to happen. But at the same time, I think what the Pakistanis are scared of is that the Indians are using Afghanistan as a way to fund and support some of these separatist groups in Pakistan.
You note that Pakistan may well soon plunge into the failed state category. What would that mean for the region? We're talking about a country that is, you know, that has nuclear arms, being a failed state.
Well, you know, let me be very clear. I mean, Pakistan, I don't think, is a failed state at the moment. It's an anarchic state. There are, you know, all sorts of very acute problems, and it could become a failing state without a doubt if the government and the bureaucracy crack up, melt down, and cease providing any services to the people. But yes, it would, any further deterioration in Pakistan would be of you know, huge concern to the international community.
Well, who's in charge, President Zardari or the military?
Well, you know, the military is in charge of national security policy and foreign policy and the nuclear weapons. So the military has a kind of veto on all these basic issues. So, for example, relations with India, Afghanistan, the United States are all in the hands of the military. And, of course, the war against the extremists. Whether the military wants to mount an attack or not mount an attack is not something that is decided upon by the prime minister or president.
And it seems to be sometimes yes, sometimes no. I guess some of the groups still work as proxies of the military, and other groups are obviously fighting against the military, attacking within Pakistan.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we've got the growth of the Pakistani Taliban in which, you know, a lot of them believe in overthrowing the state and wanting to create an Islamic state, and are fighting the military in order to achieve that. Others are not fighting the military, but are fighting the Americans in Afghanistan alongside the Taliban. So, you know, it's a very confusing. And then there are all the groups who've been fighting in India and Kashmir. So, you know, you have a very large reserve of trained, battle-experienced manpower that belong to these extremist groups. And the problem is, you know, how do you get rid of them? I mean, how do you deal with them? And that is something that Pakistan so far, in 10 years after 9/11, has really not tackled.
And the American U.S. government has suggested that Pakistan has been supporting the Haqqani group, which is probably the most dangerous group in working on the border and in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, all the Taliban leadership are in Pakistan.
Do they not know where they are? I mean, they denied that they knew where Osama bin Laden was, even though he was in plain sight.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Pakistani authorities certainly know where the Taliban leadership is, and there is a constant dialogue between the two. And the Haqqani network, of course, is one of the most stridently anti-American, and a network that has been living in Pakistan for more than 35 years. So they're very well rooted in Pakistan, and they have been used by the intelligence services of Pakistan all these years. So it's not a recent sort of relationship or a recent history. It's been going on for a long time.
Currently, the Pakistani economy has a 2.6% growth rate, but would need to grow at 9% a year just to employ the population that's under the age of 20. That doesn't seem to be likely to happen. Are funds now being allocated to developing the economy?
It's a very dire situation. The economic crisis is going to get worse and could possibly implode. I mean, we have no energy in the country. You know, for example, in Lahore, there's been, my hometown, there's been no gas for over 6 months.
What do you mean, petroleum for the cars?
The stoves and heating. There's been no gas. Electricity is only coming 8 or 10 hours a day out of 24 hours. So, you know, there's this very serious economic crisis. Obviously, industry has collapsed.
If it doesn't have electricity.
Yeah, yeah. Without energy, you know, there's a great shortage of energy. And there are very severe economic problems, which have got worse since the breakdown of relations with the U.S.
Well, you say that Pakistan's important strategic location should have been an economic asset.
Yeah.
But now it's a liability.
Yeah. Well, you know, Pakistan is so strategically placed between India and Iran, between Central Asia and the Gulf. Pakistan could have been a perfect land bridge for trade and economic development and, you know, bringing all these countries, you know, goods to one another over land. And, you know, instead we are surrounded by neighbors who don't like us. We're surrounded by neighbors who are at war or we're at war with them. And so how can the economy grow and prosper under such conditions?
My guest is Ahmed Rashid. His latest book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There was a report in today's Times that suggested that Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani could resign by this weekend if his confrontation with the Pakistan Supreme Court continues. Do you think the country is on the verge of another political crisis?
It could be, and it has been for many, many months, because there have been all sorts of efforts, both by the Supreme Court and the military, to get rid of the government. And they are now reaching a crescendo. You know, whether the Prime Minister is forced to resign, we have to see. But there's no doubt that, you know, with this political crisis that has been going on for so long, how can you improve the economy? How can you stabilize the country? How can you have better relations with the U.S. and chart out a new foreign policy?
Well, we usually assume that the courts will be look for the best solution. But from American viewpoint, the Pakistani courts are in conflict with our goals in many cases. The support, for example, of the Pakistani scientists who sold nuclear secrets to North Korea and to Libya and elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, the courts now have become certainly more strident in that they're even exposing the intelligence agencies, the ISI, as to the disappearances of individuals over the years and other such cases. But at the same time, they seem to be, you know, gunning for the government and trying to bring the government down. They have become very politicized, and I think that's probably what has become so dangerous for any Supreme Court.
80% of the $11.8 billion that the United States has sent to Pakistan in the years between 2001 and 2008 has gone to the military. Can we start sending that money somewhere else, or would that be impossible?
Well, I think I'd know. I mean, you know, there was a major effort by Richard Holbrooke to actually fund civilian development and education and other things in Pakistan, which was much appreciated by Pakistani citizens and civilians. And I think the Obama administration wanted to shift the aid focus away from the military to developing the country's economy. And I think that was something very positive. But of course, it's all cracked up because of this worsening relationship with the United States. And all aid is currently suspended.
Do the Pakistanis support talks with the Taliban?
Yes, very much
so. For Afghanistan?
The Pakistanis have been pushing for a long time for the Americans to have talks with the Taliban. But the Pakistanis have also been pushing for a seat at the table for those talks.
In November 2010, Germany was able to arrange for a face-to-face meeting between two American officials and a senior Taliban envoy. How did that come about?
Well, the Taliban actually sent a message to the Americans through the Germans and Qatar that it wanted to talk to the Americans. And there were several meetings between German envoys and the Taliban, laying down the rules of the game, as it were. And then, you know, we have had negotiations between American and Taliban envoys for the past year. Now, they haven't gone very far.
These latest crises have led the Taliban to suspend
any talks. I mean that's been, you know, detrimental. But I think I think the Taliban will resume talks.
But it is interesting that neither the ISI nor the British MI6 were told about the meetings that the Germans arranged.
No, the Americans were informed. The White House was certainly well informed, and the Germans were carrying out these meetings with the express desire to obviously bring in the Americans, because the Taliban were not interested in talking to the Germans per se. They wanted to talk to the Americans.
Well, if there are negotiations, should we assume that the ideology of the Taliban and its leader, Mullah Omar, has changed much over the years? Or are we going to just see the Taliban come back in, destroy statues of Buddha, for example, force women once again into their homes, and all the other things that seem to be the terrible excesses of the Taliban?
No, I think the Taliban do want to negotiate an end to the war. I think they have moderated their positions on a lot of things, such as education and attitude to women. For example, they are allowing girls' schools now to operate have said they want girls to go to school. They have distanced themselves from Al-Qaeda. They have said that they will not allow any foreign terrorist group in Afghanistan. And ultimately, the aim is not a Taliban-run government, but a power-sharing agreement between President Karzai and the Taliban. That would be the ultimate aim. But that can only follow a reduction in the violence on the ground and confidence-building measures between the Americans and the Taliban.
Well, there are two other issues. We have to wonder whether President Karzai is an honest broker here, and also whether the surge has been effective enough to force the Taliban to make real concessions.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism of Karzai for not being an honest broker. For example, he's not built a consensus in the country for talks with the Taliban. A lot of Afghans are still against it. A lot of Afghans suspect that he's got some ulterior motive to stay in power beyond 2014 when his term as president expires. There are a lot of doubts about Karzai's intentions. And certainly, if he wants these talks to succeed, he has to do far more than he's done so far.
You note that Pakistan and Afghanistan have a greater impact on the world's stability than any other place on earth. So why is it just the responsibility of the United States to deal with Pakistan? India and China are right there. Why can't they be better brokers here?
Well, India is considered an enemy, by the Pakistan military, not so much by the people now, but certainly by the military. So India can't be a broker or a pressure point. China certainly can. China has a very good relationship with Pakistan. It's very close to the military. But China, as you know, never wants to push the envelope as far as its relations with neighboring countries are concerned. So, for example, China has not been particularly helpful over North Korea as when the Americans asked for help.
But it's had conflict with India, so you would think that they would be a little more amenable to dealing with Pakistan.
Well, they are right now. I mean, you know, they have dealt with Pakistan in a very positive way. What the Americans are asking for the Chinese to do is to put more pressure on the Pakistanis to tone down this Islamic radicalism. Now, this, for the first time, is something that is hitting China, because the Muslim community in China, the Uyghur ethnic group, is being radicalized. And the Chinese are very worried about this, and they consider that a lot of this radicalization is coming out of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Nancy in Manhattan has written in, she writes, during the Cold War, the United States maintained military bases in Pakistan, including an Air Force base in Peshawar that was home to American soldiers and their families. But after the Cold War, the U.S. seemed to forget Pakistan, at least until September 11th. Doesn't our limited attention span play a role in Pakistan's ambivalence about working with the United States?
I think that's very true. And I think that's one of the main reasons why people are so angry and why it's so easy to spread anti-Americanism in Pakistan. Because, you know, after the Cold War, for 20 years, it was the U.S.-Pakistan relationship was one of stop, go, stop, go. And there were sanctions at one point, and the sanctions were lifted. Then there was aid. Now the aid has stopped again. I think Obama has been gone out of his way to stress that, you know, we want a long-term relationship with Pakistan. But, you know, the Pakistanis are still really not trusting of the Americans.
Well, you said that President Bush helped create this mess. Is President Obama doing the right thing to clean it up?
Well, I mean, if you look at the picture today, relations have never been so bad between the United States and Pakistan. Now, that's not all the fault of Obama. I think partly it's the fault of Pakistan also. But relations were never so bad during the Bush era.
Well, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan. For most of the world, that was a good thing. In Pakistan, it has caused great anger.
Well, exactly. And Pakistan has not yet answered the real question as to what Osama was doing there, how he was there, who was possibly helping him. Rather, the government and the military took umbrage at the fact that U.S. Special Forces went in there without permission, took out Osama, and then left. And so it has become an issue of national sovereignty.
On the other hand, if they had gone in with and asked for permission, it is likely, at least based on my understanding of the situation, that Osama bin Laden would have been warned.
Well, this is what the Americans say. I mean, we don't know the truth, but clearly, you know, the relationship between the CIA and the ISI had deteriorated considerably.
Ahmed Rashid's book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. It's kind of depressing. The book is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed. We'll be right back.